Санкт-Петербург. 20 ноября 1998 года.
Депутат Государственной Думы Галина Старовойтова.
Она была ярким политиком.
Но страна потрясена.
Сегодня появились новые данные в расследовании еще одного громкого дела.
Расследование громкого дела об убийстве Галины Старовойтовой.
Точнее, непосредственного заказчика.
Авторитетном питерском бизнесмене Владимире Барсукове.
Дело об убийстве Старовойтовой можно считать на сегодняшний день полностью раскрытым.
Russia solved a contract killing this week. It was an assassination that gripped the nation, shook the elite, and led to a massive outpouring of grief. The victim was a leading Democrat with close ties to former President Boris Yeltsin. The mastermind was a politically powerful man with a violent streak. No, I'm not talking about the Boris Nemtsov assassination. The case Russian investigators are wrapping up is 16 years and 4 months old. The November 20th, 1998 killing of State Duma deputy and human rights campaigner Galina Starovoitova in St. Petersburg. And the man the authorities are fingering for the hit is the exact person who many suspected from the very start. Vladimir Barsukov, also known as Vladimir Kumarin. That name may not mean a lot now, but in the 1990s, Barsukov was one of the most feared gangsters in the country and one of the most powerful men in Russia's second city. And how he went from being untouchable to expendable tells us a lot about how Russia works. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's organized crime and security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there.
And also joining us via Skype from Miami, Ohio, is Karen Dawisha, director of the Heviger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at the University of Miami, Ohio, and author of the recently published and excellent book, Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? Welcome to the podcast, Karen. Good to have you back.
Thanks, Brian.
Well, this story this week caught my eye for a lot of reasons. I mean, I did it on the Daily Vertical. I wrote a blog about it, and there's reasons for this. I knew Galina Starovoitova fairly well. So this case coming to what appears to be a conclusion is of personal interest to me. This was also one of the first really big stories I covered as a journalist working in St. Petersburg in the 90s. But there's other reasons beyond this why it caught my eye. Coming on the heels of the Boris Nemtsov assassination, I thought it had relevance today as well. Many people, of course, today suspect that Ramzan Kadyrov, the Chechen leader, of ordering the Nemtsov hit, but most at the same time view him as pretty untouchable. Well, back in 1998, many, myself included, suspected that Barsukov, at that time he was known as Kumarin, that his hand was behind the Starovoitova assassination, but we all understood that he was untouchable. Mark, let's start with you, since you're our resident expert on all things crooks and mafia. How does a powerful, politically connected gangster like Vladimir Barsukov, aka Kumarin, go from being untouchable to being utterly expendable, which is what he is today? And what does this tell us about how Russia operates?
Well, no one is untouchable. That is the key thing. Everyone, as it were, has a price tag on them, economic, political, social, or whatever. It's more a question of whether the state is willing to pay that particular price at that particular time to touch them.
So the price of Barsukov's head has gone down considerably in the last 16 years, I would presume.
Well, yeah, I mean, what happened was, obviously in the 1990s, I mean, I know we'll be talking more about the rise of Tambovskaya later on in the podcast. But sure, in the 1990s, he and his group took opportunities that came up to create what could be described as a criminal political venture that became dominant in St. Petersburg, and perhaps most worryingly of all, became visibly dominant in St. Petersburg. Again, we'll talk about here some acquiring the epithet of the night governor.
The night governor,
sort of the,
yeah.
the alternative power node within St. Petersburg. Now, that was not unusual in the 1990s, but there was little place for that in Putin's new power vertical, and particularly in St. Petersburg. So what in a way happened was that at a very time when actually Barsukov's own political standing was beginning to be nibbled away, he also became awkward and embarrassing for a regime that was much, much more willing and able to take action. And therefore, his arrest was really a very, very substantive reminder that the state is the biggest gang in town. And it's worth noting that when he was taken down, it was done very much by forces from Moscow.
Yes, they did not rely on Petersburg law enforcement.
Exactly. They sent two emergency ministries planes that were full of officers from Moscow. They grabbed him. They brought him back to Moscow's Lefortovo prison, and they put him in a court in Moscow.
In Moscow, yeah.
So in some ways, this was also, I mean, taking down Barsukov was not just simply showing that organized crime had to operate to a new set of rules. It was also a reminder that Moscow was the dominant force.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that, I mean, although we can't exclude the possibility that it's happening now just simply out of sort of the workings of the machines of justice, not everything in Russia, whatever we might sometimes suspect, is a conspiracy. The fact that you now have this chap, Mikhail Gluschenko, who is willing to come forward and testify that Barsukov was the man behind the Starovoytov
under
assassination.
A plea agreement, and he's
exactly.
And he's considered the middleman in the Starovoytov assassination, again, which is what many people suspected 16 years ago. But
precisely. I mean, so it could just simply be that he has had enough. I mean, you know, he's an ex-Duma figure, probably not enjoying life as a convict. But it's much more likely that this could be a distraction from the Nemtsov case, but also a warning to Kadyrov, precisely that no one is untouchable.
Right. This didn't get a lot of play. I mean, there was a story in Kommersant that definitely caught my attention, because anything about this case I kind of follow. And when I saw that, oh, my God, they're actually naming Barsukov in print as the person Gluschenko is going to finger, I was like, oh, my God, they're actually going after the person that we all thought did it. Going back to the 90s, I mean, the Tombovskaya Grupperovka and Barsukov's own power was really reaching its apex just before Putin came to power. I mean, it was really, really cresting. I mean, as you said, they became very visible. He changed his name in it was 1999 when he became head of the St. Petersburg Fuel Company, if I'm not mistaken. He had just won the gas war in St. Petersburg, which had which was saw a lot of fireworks, including somebody assassinated on Universitetskaya Naberezhnaya on the university embankment with a rocket propelled grenade. They had really reached their apex. He had his man in Smolny in St. Petersburg City Hall. Vladimir Yakovlev, the governor of St. Petersburg, was widely seen as a Tombovskaya project. And then Putin came to power, and it's almost like it was the passing of an era, no? I mean, it was like they had reached their apex just as the new order was about to come into being.
Well, you know, St. Petersburg Fuel Company was formed in 98. Actually, Putin gave significant licenses mm-hmm. to allow the establishment of a monopoly for the fuel company while he was still in power. So 98, though, was important because, of course, at the end of it, in November, Starovoytova was killed. But 98 was, of course, the year that Putin became head of FSB. Yes. And 98 was a year in which there was a huge number of settling of scores, including, but not exclusively, in St. Petersburg. Mm-hmm. So Starovoytova was the end of that. Well, it wasn't actually the end, because it went on into 99 as well. But in St. Petersburg, you had one of the first heads of Petersburg Fuel Company and one of his deputies being subject to an assassination attempt. And I think significantly, the murder in the summer of a journalist, one of the very first journalists, Anatoly Levin-Utkin. He was the deputy editor of a new magazine called Yuridicheski Peterburg Sevodnya, and he was dead before issue number 3, not because he went after Kumara, but because there were articles in there about Putin. And that newspaper was suppressed. It just disappeared entirely mm-hmm. from libraries and so forth. I actually have it, and I put it up on my book's website, the scanned copies, and you can see there the charges against Putin and others. But I would have to say that I disagree slightly, Brian, and Mark with the thing that we finally know who ordered the Starovoytova. I don't think that we know at all who ordered. I mean, look, Kumaran is not just willy-nilly going around and killing people who have stated that they may have presidential ambitions. He's a businessman, and he does things himself on order. So the question is, just like with the Kadyrov trail to the Nemtsov killing. Now, Kadyrov is a slightly different thing because of Charlie Hebdo, and if you believe that, that's fine.
I don't either.
But there is one person in common, and that's Viktor Zolotov. Zolotov was helping to clean things up and smoothing the path, and he wasn't the only one doing that for Putin, and he's continuing to do it today. The reemergence this week, or at the end of last week, of Zolotov at the side of Kadyrov is, I think, very interesting. And Zolotov was, of course, as the head of Baltic Escort, a very important person in St. Petersburg in the 1990s. Of course, by 98, he was already in Moscow, but Baltic Escort continued to operate in Petersburg. Now, in addition to that, Kumaran, as the head of his own security organization, not just Tambovskaya, but actually RIF Security,
which is legitimate security organization. Yeah.
Right, a private security organization, provided, they say, actually Nemtsov says, that they provide a security for the Ozero Dacha cooperative.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
You know, there's a triangulation here that I think that we need to pay attention to when it comes to who really would benefit from Starovoitova not getting into a presidential race in 1999.
Well, yeah, I agree with you that the presence of Zolotov is interesting in both of these cases. But I would, looking at Petersburg politics in the 90s, Putin and Starovoitova often found themselves on the same side of almost every political battle. And I want to get into this in a little bit more in the second half when we look at Petersburg in the 90s, because Putin occupied what I reluctantly call the liberal side of the political space in St. Petersburg. He gave support to people like Starovoitova. She was locked in a bitter struggle with Vladimir Yakovlev, the governor of St. Petersburg at the time, who was a Tambovskaya project, who had close ties to Kumarin / Barsukov at the time. So my suspicions at the time were not going toward Putin so much as going towards Yakovlev Tambovskaya. You're right to point out, yes, Putin had extensive dealings with Tambovskaya, as everybody that was in St. Petersburg had to have if you were in power in the 90s. But we'll get much more into that in the second half. Karen, what about the question I posed to Mark right at the outset about how somebody like Kumarin goes from being utterly untouchable to completely expendable now? What does that tell us about Russia and how it operates?
Well, there has been a generalized decline in the use of known mafia, if I can just use that generic term, known mafia figures. That's not to say that they are not still available to do wet operations on order inside and outside Russia, but they have other people who can do that now. They have the Night Wolves. They have Kadyrov. And so, you know, Kumaran presents a sort of too expensive face. I mean, they can pay Kadyrov whatever he needs to keep the lid on in Chechnya, but he's also doing lots of other interesting things for them, and ditto with the Night Wolves. So it would be very difficult for them politically to put Kumaran up on a stage on Red Square as they did with Night Wolves and thank him for his role in the annexation of Crimea.
So this type of gangster just isn't needed anymore. It's time
not
for
needed.
A different.
They can take it all now.
Right. Yeah.
They don't have to share. I think also in the 90s, they really didn't – I mean, they really needed mafia money to do a lot of projects. They don't need it anymore. Yeah. Well, they do, but I don't know if the mafia is going to share with them.
I see Mark writing furiously, which leads me to believe he has something to say. What is it, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd beware of these assumptions of the Putin link, saying that, you know, this journalist got assassinated because of what he was said about Putin. I mean, we don't really know that kind of thing. And I think the very problem about Barsukov was precisely that he wasn't just a businessman who did things to order. He had his own agenda. He would do things himself, and therefore that's become, you know, that's why he became problematic. Particularly once, actually, you had more of a clash opening up between the Moscow and St. Petersburg underworlds. Was it in 2003, Kostya Mogila,
right.
Kostya the Grave,
Kostya
was assassinated
the Grave, yeah.
In St. Petersburg. And anyway, because he was precisely meant to be Moscow's
man,
it's called ambassador.
Yes.
And in fact, he'd kind of gone native. So I think
he was an interesting gangster, by the way. I mean, Kostya Mogila, yeah. He got, you know how he got that name? It wasn't because he put a lot of people in their graves. It's because he ran the cemetery.
He was an undertaker.
He ran the racket, right. He ran the racket.
But so I think in general terms, you know, again, you know, if we talk about, well, they can do this, I think we have to be sort of sure about, you know, who they are. But we've got to realize, I mean, that Barsukov is now pretty much a nobody. I mean, I think this is it. It's not as if they're going after anyone who's important. And a lot of these figures aren't. I mean, the Night Wolves, they're faux Hell's Angels. They actually have no real, I would say, clout, except essentially symbolic propaganda clout. They don't actually have any real military muscle. Kadyrov is a very different case. I mean, and the Kremlin is still clearly willing to deal with criminals. I mean, one could look at Aksyonov in Crimea and the extent to which the local self-defense militias, quote-unquote, who were there alongside the Spetsnaz and naval infantry of the Little Green Men, I mean, were basically local thugs, given armbands and assault rifles. But I think the key point is we have to realize where the axis of power is. I mean, going back to the counterpoint, I'm not sure if I would say in the 1990s that people needed the mafia money. The point is, the mafia had the money largely because corrupt elements of the state allowed them to make it. We're still talking about, I think, not so much a process whereby money is converted into political power, as political power is converted into money. So, I mean, I think if we're going to look at what's going on now, it's very much, I think, about, well, what are the politics behind it? Dragging up this case, there's no obvious reason for it. I mean, in terms of the natural trajectory. Starovoytova is a historic figure by now, alas.
Yeah.
It's a question of, well, as I said, either we decide that this is just simply because Glushenko finally decided he wanted to, you know, strike a deal, which is possible. Or, more likely, I think, we have to think, well, okay, well, how does this affect the politics of the here and now? And again, I think this is where going after someone who, at least in his pomp, was an untouchable becomes a particularly significant factor.
Yeah, no, I had not thought of that, Mark, but I think that's an interesting point, that this could be a message to Kadyrov. And it was sent very subtly. I mean, it wasn't broadcast on Vesti. There was an article in Vedomosti, there was an article in Kommersant, it broke in Fontanka Rue, in Petersburg, the small investigative unit there.
It was also run on then RAPSI.
It was run on RAPSI.
The key politics and, you know, politics and policing official site.
But and going back to Kumarin / Barsukov, we got it so we don't confuse our listeners. These are the same person. He just changed his name. And I always knew him as Kumarin. When I lived and worked in Petersburg, it was Kumarin. Around the time I was moving out of Petersburg to Moscow, I just saw this item that he changed his name to Barsukov right around the time he became head of the St. Petersburg Fuel Company, which I saw as an effort for him to go legit. He had given an interview to a local paper, which was very rare. Kumarin didn't talk to the press, and he gave this interview, and he was really affable, and he said, what are you talking about, the Tambovsky? It's not a group. It's not like we have membership cards and pay dues, and that was the quote everybody pulled out of there. But they were not a state within a state in Petersburg. They were the state. And essentially, I mean, he had the local FSB chief was his, Cherkesov was tied to him. The governor was his man. The deputy speaker of the city council, Viktor Novosyolov, was his man. So, I mean, not his man, but a Tambovska man. So they had the entire city elite wired. He was not only the night governor. Tambovska was like a shadow government.
But it was a St. Petersburg shadow government.
Exactly.
So in part, taking it down was exactly reminding people that the 90s are over, the days of the feudal baronies are over.
Right.
we now have a strong central state again.
Yeah, yeah. It was as much about federalism as fighting organized crime in that sense. One area I wanted to go to, and two things I wanted to talk about before we go into the second half, and we'll get into the nitty gritty of St. Petersburg in the 90s and this environment that Putin emerged out of, political assassinations in the 90s versus today. I mean, the Stedovoitova hit got me thinking about the news about the Stedovoitova assassination in the context of the Nemtsov assassination got me thinking about this. Political assassinations in the 90s, what purpose did they fulfill? Why did they happen? As opposed to political assassinations today. Either of you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, in the 90s, I would say that there's a very specific period of the 90s that bears some resemblance to the situation today, and that is the period of the rise of the Siloviki. Of course, you know, one could trace this rise right back to 1991 if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. I mean, Illarionov's latest contributions would suggest that's the case, and that they were also linked to Gaidar and Chubais. But leaving that interesting hypothesis aside, I do think that if one looks at this from the point of view of political projects, assassination as part of a political project, that 98 is a very critical year. There's a sort of clearing, beginning of the clearing of the decks. It's not just about obtaining market share, as the early 90s was in the war, you know, nickel wars and all of that sort of thing. This is much more targeted. I mean, Starovoitova, I mean, we all remember Valeria Novodvorskaya, and she, of course, continued to do work on the Starovoitova murder. And in Granny in November of 2008, she talked about the connection of the mafia to Viktor Cherkasov. And Brian, you just mentioned Cherkasov as somebody who you believe was a part of was linked to Tambov.
Was linked to Tambov.
Let's just say that he was linked to Tambov. Well, I mean, he was with Starovoitova the day that she was murdered. So according to Novodvorskaya, and
That I had not heard. She flew back from Moscow to Petersburg that night. And she arrived in Petersburg fairly late in the evening, was escorted back to her apartment by her press secretary and legislative aide, Ruslan Linkov, and they were both shot in the well of the apartment building. So Cherkasov must have been in Moscow that day.
Novodvorskaya does not state which city that they met in, but that they met that Cherkasov accompanied Starovoitova just before the murder, and her claim was that was because he knew that she was going to be killed. And then in the kind of war amongst the Siloviki in 04, where Cherkasov, I mean, there was some view that there had been a difference of opinion with Cherkasov not wanting the FSB to go after Tambov, perhaps because of his own connections. It's unclear, of course. I mean, all of this is extremely hypothetical.
There was also a rift breaking out in Tambov at this time between the Malyshev and the Kumarin factions as well, which culminated in the killing of Viktor Novosyolov, the deputy speaker of the St. Petersburg Legislative Assembly, the following year. Mark, what are your thoughts on assassinations in the 90s versus today, and how this?
Well, I mean, I think we have to remember that obviously the overwhelming majority of contract killings and assassinations in Russia are nothing to do with politics.
Yeah, okay, but political assassinations.
I mean, obviously, I think, and also that actually the majority of what we really think of as political assassinations are local. They're not the big showy. They're not the Nemtsovs and Starovoitovas. They take place all across the country. Remember, I mean, the overall level of contract killing is quite close now, still to the sort of high, you know, 1990s. It's just that there are far, far fewer collateral casualties, you know, people, bystanders who are caught in it. So Most of the assassinations is just, I don't know, a local journalist being gunned down because of local politics. When we do look at the sort of the big name assassinations, I think what they represent is a failure of other means. This is very much the last option for most. I mean, okay, you know, Kadyrov might have a slightly different perspective. But in terms of the sort of the rational, hard-nosed, frankly pragmatic opportunists of Moscow, they don't want to kill people, not because they're humane, but because it's just bad business, if nothing else. So, I mean, I think, again, when we see assassinations take place, it is because of a failure of other mechanisms rather than anything else.
And how is that different? Has that remained a constant in the 90s and today, or was there just because there
were
more?
I think in the 1990s it was much more free for all. I mean, apart from the fact you had more centers of power, and I think in a way more people who could assert violence, whether it's straightforward assassinations or even just other ways. I mean, I still remember, for example, Gusinski's motorcade being stopped by the presidential security forces and so forth, you know, where you actually therefore had an armed showdown between FSB, police and presidential security. You know, those were the good old days when you had multiple arms-bearing agencies.
Some of them different branches of law enforcement.
Absolutely, but each overtly carrying out their own agenda with, frankly, very, very little control from the Kremlin. I think things are very different now in terms of how many such agencies there are, how many such sort of agendas are acceptable sort of to be carried out so publicly. So, I mean, things are much, much more controlled these days. But as I said, I mean, in many ways, the assassinations reflect failures of either control or failures of being able to use the alternative methods.
Unless you have a wild card like Kadyrov operating.
Exactly. This is why, I mean, I think that he is a sort of case of all bets are off.
Right. Now, the other thing I wanted to touch on before we move into the Petersburg of the 90s is the relationship of organized crime to the state in that time versus today. I did a blog not long ago saying called The Return of Goodfellas, making the argument that Russia was a mafia state in the 90s, but it was a mafia state with a weak godfather, which allowed the underbosses to act out, and therefore you saw a lot of contract killings. Today you have a mafia state with a strong godfather and tight discipline on the underbosses, and assassinations are much less common and frequent, as you pointed out just now, Mark. But what's happening now led me to ask the question, is Goodfellas coming back? Are we back? Are we seeing signs that we're going to see a breakdown in that discipline? Mark, why don't you tackle that first? Then?
There clearly is a crisis of sorts taking place, I think, within the Kremlin and the government system as a whole. And that crisis is likely to become visible in more violence on the streets. Either, I mean, again, if we look at the Nemtsov killing and we assume it's not just some random nut job, which I think we can assume, either it's because the Kremlin feels that it can't control the situation by any other means and therefore has to resort to the most overt and, frankly, politically counterproductive forms, which, again, is significant in its own right, or, as I think is more likely, that the Kremlin is not able to control or willing to control its underbosses, to follow the metaphor, or which, again, says something about quite what's going on in the Kremlin, that we have more and more agendas beginning to emerge, more and more agencies that are at least willing to do what they think is right, either for the state or for their own interests. Mm. So I think we can often use these kind of overt expressions of violence as precisely indicators of wider processes that are going on behind the scenes.
Right. And you'd agree with the characterization that the mafia state in the 90s was one characterized by a weak godfather and underbosses that are acting out. And now we move until recently into a situation of a strong godfather where...
Well, I think the idea... I mean, I'm not quite sure how far Yeltsin really was the godfather in the first place. I mean, yes, he was, as it were, a weak godfather over the agencies that he was meant to control. But also the point is in the 1990s, you actually had a whole variety of multiple and competing, shall we say, gangs. And this is, again, to loop
which
this back
he couldn't
to what
control.
We're saying in St. Petersburg. Exactly. I mean, if we loop this back to what's going on in St. Petersburg, quite frankly, at that time, Moscow's control over St. Petersburg was actually distinctly limited.
It was nearly zero.
Well, I mean, it wasn't quite zero. I mean, as you can see, I mean, ultimately, you know, Moscow could assert, but again, the cost of doing so. And quite frankly, if you go further, I mean, you know, if you go to, well, Yekaterinburg, never mind, but Vladivostok, I mean, you know, outside, further you get from Moscow, you could actually see the power of the central state attenuating. Mm-hmm. So the thing in the 1990s was not only that you had a weak godfather, but actually you had a whole variety of different gangs, for want of a better word, competing for, to use Karen's expression, market share. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, now the power vertical project meant that essentially one gang was meant to control the whole country. But what we have to ask is actually how effective has that been, or certainly how effective is that now?
Is it running into the limits of its effectiveness?
Kadyrov represents, as it were, the extreme end, I think, of the local affiliate of the gang that really is a gang in its own right. Mm. But I think in many other ways we actually can see that elsewhere as well.
Right. Karen, last word to you before we move on to the second part.
Well, I'm not a big fan of the use of the word mafia state, and in general. But in particular, as applied to the 90s, I think what I would say is that why St. Petersburg became known as the criminal capital of all Russia, first of all, is because all raw materials, not all, but many raw materials shipped by train into the port, you know, into a port, they went through St. Petersburg. So the skim operation opportunities was just enormous. But also, you know, Putin goes to Moscow in 96, and despite him being in Moscow, you had three federal agencies launching an investigation into the corruption of the mayor's office in St. Petersburg under Sobchak. And so you have the kind of Moscow versus St. Petersburg elements. So Putin had a real interest in suppressing those investigations and in making sure that they didn't get very far in St. Petersburg. Of course, Yakovlev also had that interest as well. And they saw on that score, they saw eye to eye. And of course, Kumarin also was very interested in that. So you had in the beginning in 1998, somebody in charge of FSB, and even before that, his federal appointments, Putin's federal appointments, he was interested in this. Somebody in charge of FSB who was not working in tandem with three other federal agencies, including the Attorney General's or the Procurator General's office, Skuratov. So, and we remember what happened with Skuratov.
Yes.
So everybody thought that Skuratov was out to get Yeltsin, but from Putin's own point of view, Putin had his own deal with Skuratov, his own reason to make sure that Skuratov's investigations were stymied in Petersburg. So that is why I think that he became an ally of Yeltsin. But Yeltsin, I think, did not know that this was another aspect of the Putin project, that Yeltsin really didn't know that Putin wasn't a very loyal person, that he had his own interests, and they were related to Petersburg.
Yeah. No, Skuratov had gone after Sobchak long before he went after Yeltsin.
That's right.
What we had at the time, though, is the different federal law enforcement agencies were balkanized and were pursuing their own interests. It's this function, and I agree with you, Karen, that I don't like the way the term mafia state has been used. In the colloquial use to describe Russia, as I told Mark's students in a lecture a couple weeks ago, I'd like to turn it from this cheap jargon into an actual heuristic that we can use to understand Russia. And that's what I've been trying to do with this, looking at the different what exactly is a mafia state, how do we expect one to behave, and what are the different kinds of mafia states that operate. But I think what was going on with the federal law enforcement agencies in the 90s, both in the investigations of the Sobchak administration and by extension Putin, and it's the other investigations into Yeltsin, I think you just saw a balkanization of law enforcement in Russia, where investigations were simply a political tool in clan battles, and I think that was that's I see more chaos in that than conspiracy, to be honest, in the 90s. But we can get into more of that as we look at St. Petersburg a little bit closer in the second half here. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and zero in on the gangland shooting gallery that was St. Petersburg in the 1990s. The environment in which Vladimir Putin cut his his political teeth. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's organized crime and security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Miami, Ohio, is Karen Dawisha, director of the Havegger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at the University of Miami, Ohio, and author of the recently published and excellent book, Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Сегодня Санкт-Петербург входит в число самых криминальных городов.
Тамбовскую ОПГ, репутация которой в комментариях.
Тамбовский в Питере, Тамбовский в Испании.
Наступила эпоха малиновых пиджаков.
Владимир Кумарин планировал совершить рейдерский захват.
Питерского криминального авторитета Владимира Барсукова Кумарина.
Всегда писали о нем как о лидере Тамбовской преступной группы.
Имеет отношение некая Тамбовская сообщество.
Это война была самая настоящая.
It was known as Russia's capital of crime, and the biggest crime syndicate in town was Vladimir Barsukov's Tambovskaya Grupperovka. But Barsukov was much more than a gangster, and Tambov was much more than a gang. He was known as the night governor, and the Tambovskaya Grupperovka was something of a shadow government. Every serious politician in Russia's second city, including one Vladimir Putin, had to deal with him in one way or another. Karen, your book deals with Putin's St. Petersburg years, and you illuminated a lot about how he operated in that environment. What was Putin's relationship with Barsukov and Tambov, and with the St. Petersburg criminal underworld, for that matter, and what does that show us about how this man operates?
Well, you won't find any pictures of Kumarin and Putin together.
No.
But you will find pictures of Zolotov and Kumarin together. So people like Zolotov were used as the cutout for the relations with organized crime, reminding your listeners that Zolotov is now first deputy minister of interior in charge of all internal forces.
And Zolotov was the head of Anatoly Sobchak's security in the 1990s in St. Petersburg, but he was basically a Putin man.
Right, and he was also in charge of Putin's security. So initially, Putin didn't have security except through the city or through the local security forces, the official security forces. But then a decree was signed giving, after the battle for the port began and Putin's wife was involved in a very serious car accident, a decree was signed extending security by Baltic escort to Putin and his family. So it was Zolotov who had the relationship with Kumarin. And it was Zolotov who, even after he became head of Putin's presidential bodyguard detail, would go to Petersburg and be seen in the presence of Kumarin. And including at the funeral of his partner, Roman Sepov, who died in 2004, some say by nuclear poisoning, 2 years before Litvinenko. Zolotov was at that funeral, as was Kumarin, and was publicly photographed together.
Mm-hmm. So Zolotov was the kind of was Putin's conduit to the criminal underworld?
Yeah, I mean, maybe he wasn't the only one, but if as you say, other people who had previously been in the Leningrad KGB had their own contacts, then people who rose up with Putin, there may have been many links into that underworld, but Zolotov, I think, was certainly one of them.
Now, what was the nature of Putin's dealings with them? What did you uncover anything about that? I mean, we know that Kumarin's legitimate security agency would provided security for the Azerodacha complex. Anything else come to mind?
Well, as we've mentioned, the Petersburg Fuel Company, Putin gave them a position of monopoly over gas stations, if we can use the American phrase, in Petersburg. They were tied together in the German registered company, the St. Petersburg real estate company called SPAG for short. Putin was listed as openly as a member of the advisory committee. A letter from Sobchak was on the board encouraging people from the West to invest in that. And you had Kumarin and Smirnov, who was another link mm-hmm. with Kumarin. Smirnov was head of the Ozero Cooperative. Listed as members of the board.
Now, an interesting thing here that I always come back to, and I'm thinking back to these days, and this is really classic Putin in a lot of ways, but the liberals in Petersburg saw Putin as their guy. I mean, yeah, he's a Czechist, but he's our Czechist. He's a son of a bitch, but he's ours. That was the way, that pretty much summarizes how Petersburg liberals viewed Putin in the 90s. He was associated with the kind of the Chubais group. In every political battle I covered in St. Petersburg, regardless of whether it was over the budget or if it was over the city charter or whatever, Putin threw his weight on what we would consider, and I know these terms are relative, the more liberal side of things. I remember when Putin became head of the FSB in 98, and I had human rights advocates like Yuri Schmidt, God rest his soul, were praising this and saying this is a good thing that we get somebody like Putin running the FSB at the time. But at the same time, Tambov actually probably thought he was their man too. He was playing both sides. He was being all things to all people. Tambov, on the other hand, came down on the what I would call the more reactionary side of every political battle that I covered in St. Petersburg. So it often looked to the untrained eye like Putin and Kumarin were on opposite sides of the political battles there, which is interesting in the light of all this. But it is in a lot of ways classic Putin. Being the ultimate operative and being all things to all people.
Right. I mean, the key thing is that Tambov operated, let's just say, exclusively in the black zone. Mm-hmm. And what Putin gave them was a door into the legal zone, into the real money, which was raw materials.
Mm-hmm.
And by controlling the issuing of licenses for goods out of the country, Putin could make legal what previously had been illegal, smuggling. So and smuggling was lucrative as far as it went, but it wasn't comparable in terms of its financial benefit to legalized participation in the market. Mm-hmm. And that's why Putin was beloved by liberals and the mafia.
Right.
Because he favored privatization.
Right. And that meant giving a lot to Kumarin and Tambov. Yeah, it's worth noting that the Tambovska Grupirovka started out as just your basic extortion racket.
And they never stopped doing that.
And they never stopped doing that, quite frankly. But what we saw happen, and it began during the Sobchak administration, but it really accelerated under the Yakovlev administration when the governor was basically their man in a lot of ways. They controlled real estate, banking, fuel, traffic through the ports. It was they in a lot of ways did run the city, and Kumarin slash Barsukov was really the night governor. Mark, anything to add to all of this? Well, Karen's thrown given us a lot to chew on, and I know you have things to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that obviously Tambovskaya, because sort of its rise is in many ways not so much a creation of, but a reflection of the criminalization that took place through the 1990s. I mean, by the mid-90s, Tambovskaya had moved very much beyond its initial extortion and so forth roots. As Karen says,
they outsourced it.
Well, what you ended up having actually is almost two Tambovskayas. The old-style, thuggish one, and then the increasing avtoritet, sort of white, grey, and black business side. And actually, there were a lot of serious tensions in there, particularly after they had basically absorbed the Malyshevskaya gang in the mid-1990s. And one of the key things is the way that Barsukov and other key figures within Tambovskaya had to, in effect, continue to pay off their own thugs. I mean, in the sense of the more street level underbosses. Mm-hmm. And one of those was, for example, being able to actually move your money and indeed travel abroad. I mean, it's interesting that in 2008, there was a big Spanish operation, Operation Troika, which saw arrest of about 20 senior Russian organized crime figures, disproportionately from Tambov and its sort of subset, Malyshevskaya. And precisely, actually, access to the Spanish operation was one of the ways in which the white-collar Tambovskaya bosses paid off the blue-collar ones. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, I mean, it's interesting that in this respect, Tambovskaya absolutely, basically subsumed large swaths of St. Petersburg government and St. Petersburg politics and St. Petersburg elite. I mean, obviously Putin had connections with them, but frankly, we could track pretty much any figure within the St. Petersburg elite and paint just as compelling a picture of connections with them. You could not operate in St. Petersburg without some kind of connection, knowing or unknowing, direct or indirect, with Tambovskaya. But at the same time, it also is a microcosm for what was happening within the underworld as a whole, in that you have the rise of the more white-collar autoriteti, who see that the big money is to be made precisely in business and in embezzlement of government funds. And there are kind of increasingly tense relationship with the old-style, old-school gangster, who frankly thinks that good business just means shaking down kiosk owners and clothing markets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another thing I wanted to note too is, in the run-up to the Starovoytova assassination in the late 90s, there was the biggest assassination in Petersburg before that was, and Mark, I'm interested if you remember this, the assassination of Mikhail Manevich, who was the deputy, he was deputy governor. And he was the head of CUGI, the Committee for City Property, essentially. The funny thing about CUGI, Комитет управления государственного городского имущества, which was tied to the State Property Committee, and it was essentially a federal appointment, but you were in a local government. When Sobchak lost the election in 96, Manevich was left behind in Petersburg. The rest of the Chubais economic team, and Manevich was a key member of the Chubais economic liberal team, no less so than Alexei Kudrin. But they left him back in Petersburg. He didn't want to stay. They left him in Yakovlev's government, in essentially enemy territory, to make sure that privatization went the way they wanted it to and not the way the new authorities wanted it to. Manevich was assassinated in August of 1997, just over a year before Starovoytova was. My initial suspicions on her assassination, she was looking in pretty deeply into the Manevich assassination. And again, like Starovoytova, we all suspected that went back to Kumar and Yakovlev as well. Anatoly Sobchak told me in an interview back at the time that Manevich had told him, they're trying to make me sign documents that if I sign them, I'll go to prison, but if I don't sign them, I'll get killed. So it was related to privatizations. You began to see Tambov really, tightening its grip to the point of, and this has never been proven or anything, but widely suspected that they killed a deputy governor, one who was tied to Anatoly Chubais, who was a very powerful man at that point in time.
I think it's also worth pointing out there, Brian, that there's never been a real accusation that Manevich was corrupt.
No, there hasn't. No.
As with Starovoytova. They were regarded as, both of them, pretty clean. And to be in charge of the property department.
And be clean.
and be clean was a very challenging thing. So I think it was a very early signal about how things were going in Petersburg.
Yeah, no, and talk about a brazen assassination. I mean, that was rush hour, Nevsky Prospect, the main boulevard through St. Petersburg. Manevich was being driven to work by his driver during morning rush hour and was shot by a sniper from an attic on Nevsky Prospect. I mean, it was just chilling and just amazing First of all, what kind of a shot do you have to be to hit that? It was Spetsnaz, obviously.
Clearly.
But that was a shocker. But then that was just a prelude, and that assassination was largely forgotten after the Starovoitova assassination, which really became the most shocking assassination at the time. Mark.
In many ways, Manevich was the Kostya Mogilar. I mean, it's as above, so below.
Yes.
Exactly. He at that point, he represented Moscow. He represented a foreign source of power.
Chubais.
That was greater.
The Chubais,
exactly. That was greater in sort of national terms, but locally weaker.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, in that respect, of course, he had to go because he was a proconsul rather than a sort of a corrupted local figure. Now, okay, I mean, there's actually obviously massive differences between Manevich and
yes.
a very unpleasant gangster. But I mean, in the same sort of process. So in some ways, yes, this was Tambovskaya asserting its power and locking things down in St. Petersburg. But this was also the harbinger of the fall. This was also actually a sign that ultimately what happens in Moscow is going to matter in St. Petersburg. Now, at that time, St. Petersburg could resist Moscow,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't going to be that way for long.
Yeah, Moscow looked positively impotent to do anything about this. I mean, after the Manevich assassination, and I remember I covered Manevich's funeral, and I remember one after another, Chubais and all these Moscow figures were coming up saying, we're going to get the people who did this. We're going to get, it looked almost like a mafia funeral in a lot of ways, in a very perverse sense. But they didn't. They didn't. That one's still unsolved to this day, to my knowledge. And another thing we have to bear in mind here is too, is this, there's all these complex political alliances in Russia, especially at this time. When Yakovlev defeated Sobchak for mayor, it was a lot of things. It was one, Tambov basically truly merging with the city authorities, but it was also, there was a battle between Chubais and Alexander Korsakov, who was still Yeltsin's chief of security at this time. During the 96 election. And those were two clans that were fighting it out in Moscow. It was often called Korsakov's last victory over Chubais. But at the local level, there was all these Yabloko backed Yakovlev. Yabloko was in the liberal party, Yabloko, Grigory Yavlinsky's party, was essentially in a political coalition with Tambov and Korsakov. Locally in Petersburg to defeat Sobchak. I mean, there were all sorts of strange alliances going on here. Manevich was left behind so the Chubais group would still have its man in Petersburg. Mark, I wanted to touch on is what happened to these groups that were so powerful in the 90s? Now, I mean, the Tambovskaya Grupirovka is presumably defunct now. It doesn't exist. Does Soltsevo still... What happened to these groups? And Tambovskaya and Soltsevo are the two big ones. Soltsevo was the strongest group in Moscow. Tambov was the strongest one in Petersburg. Where did they go? Where are they now?
They exist. They exist still, but they have changed. They have morphed. They have responded to the way the environment has shifted around them. Yeah, no one uses the word Tambovskaya anymore. But on the other hand, a lot of the... If I say second rank, it makes them sound as... I mean, they're still very powerful, but the people who didn't hog the limelight, the people who weren't very clearly recognized with it, such as Barsukov, I mean, they're still around, but what they have understood is precisely that you have to work with the state, not against the state. And they've focused much more on their legitimate or pretty legitimate business, shall I say legitimate by Russian standards.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, exactly, there's sweetheart deals, there's tax evasion and so forth, but it's not about being involved in heroin trafficking mm-hmm. or whatever. They've jettisoned the more dangerous, more street-level stuff. Likewise, Soltsevo is still alive and well, but in some ways it became a product of its own success. It just became too big. It is not a gang in any meaningful sense. It is closer to a club, a network. People who, when they need some particular resource or asset or favor, then these are people that they know, with whom they can trust, who can provide them with that, or at least who knows someone who can. I think what we've had is essentially a diffusion.
Mm-hmm.
There is still a lot of organized crime. There is still very, very great problems in detaching business, crime, and politics in Russia. The three sort of merge too closely mm-hmm. to really expect it to shift apart. But what has become very clear is that both common sense in terms of not getting shot or arrested, and common sense in terms of what gets you the most money, mm-hmm. is actually to move more into the white collar elements. Mm-hmm. So those who can have moved into that, and therefore obviously they eschew all the structures and seemings of gangs. We just had these looser networks.
Now, Barsukov slash Kumarin, he managed to operate. He wasn't arrested until it was 2007, I'm not mistaken, and he was sentenced in 2009. That's pretty deep into the Putin presidency. And he presumably was playing by a different set of rules all those years. What happened? Why did he fall in 2007? What led to that?
Well, I mean, Karen may well have a sort of more mm-hmm. sort of detailed sort of sense, but I mean, my view is that really by 2002 already he was not by any means a marginal figure, but he was no longer, shall we say, the night governor or anything mm-hmm. like that. But on the other hand, yes, he knew too much. He was too closely involved, and the point is, too many people knew about him. Mm-hmm. I think that's the thing. He had become a story in his own right. Mm-hmm. And so the longer he was around, again, the more potentially problematic it was. I mean, there's a whole variety of different factors that seem to have sort of come together on why to actually get rid of him at that point.
Right.
Combination of the state actually wanting to make a signal. But basically, I think it was a case of that this is a man who his mere presence says right. something about the failures of the state to truly control the gangsters.
Oh, Karen, I'm sure you'd have something to say about this. One of my first suspicions was, yeah, he knew too much, and he knew too much about Vladimir Putin. But then why let him operate for 7 years into your presidency and then take him down just as you're about to leave the Kremlin for a little 4-year interlude? Why in 2007? Why was he allowed to operate so long, and why take him down then?
Well, they say there was a conflict within the Siloviki about what to do with the continued level of criminality in Petersburg, including who to blame for Starovoitov and Manevich, that there were those who wanted to blame someone who had been a low-level person who had charged Sobchak with corruption.
You're talking about Yuri Shutov.
Yeah, I'm talking about Shutov. And to roll over his convictions till infinity. And there were those who wanted to finally deal with Tambov. So it was a tension. Often it's the case with Putin, and I know you've talked about this many times on the podcast, that, you know, he listens and thinks about things, and it can be a long time before he makes a decision. And I think that this is one case. I mean, you don't take on Kumarin just like you don't take on Kadyrov without really thinking about
it. Right.
So it could be, you know, that he was trying to decide what to do. I also think that, you know, as Putin left Petersburg in 96, some of these folks like Petrov and Malyshev left Russia and really set up operations that were closely linked with people in the Kremlin in Spain. We know from the Operation Troika and WikiLeaks data that Spain became kind of a replacement for Petersburg.
Right.
And so Putin didn't need to go to Petersburg to do this stuff. I mean, we hear from the Litvinenko inquiry in London, looking at the daily transcripts, which are absolutely fascinating, that, you know, somebody like Viktor Ivanov was running drugs into Europe via St. Petersburg in the 1990s, running Cali right. cartel drugs, which may or may not be true, but that's what's been stated in the inquiry. And, you know, Viktor Ivanov had a very elevated position under Putin.
Right.
He didn't need Kumarin
right.
if he
right.
wanted to continue to do that right. stuff. And I think what happened in if the WikiLeaks is to be believed, that Petrov and Malyshev had conversations that were wiretapped by the Spanish authorities, yes, with five sitting ministers, including the Minister of Defense, Serdyukov. Mm-hmm. So what did they need Kumarin for?
Right, right. No, and as you wrote in your book, not surprisingly, Zolotov and Cherkasov wanted to blame the contract hits in Petersburg on Yuri Shutov,
right,
who is one of the most unpleasant people ever encountered in my time in Petersburg.
And undoubtedly.
Other members of the Siloviki wanted to really come down on Tambov. Mark, you indicated you had something to say here.
Well, also just throw in one other thing. You noted the timing. I mean, that actually Barsukov went down just before Putin handed over the throne, at least nominally. Mm-hmm. Well, again, if one was thinking in terms of just tidying up loose ends, theoretically, and at some point, you know, it's clear that people around him were encouraging him to do this, Medvedev could have challenged Putin for the presidency. Now, if that were the case, then actually Barsukov might have been a useful sort of instrument at that point, mm-hmm, to sort of pull up to basically, you know, as a source of compromat, or mm-hmm, at least a sort of a trial could be used to smear Putin. So it could well have been, and I'm just speculating here, but yeah, because of the timing, that they thought actually it's handier just to deal with this guy, get him out of the way so that he doesn't represent a source of potential vulnerability if things do get messy.
So
during
just clearing the decks
thing
before giving up, yeah, the big chair, maybe. Yeah. No, it is interesting that anybody who was in the underworld and had any kind of dealings with Putin in this time has wound up either dead or in prison. I mean, if you look at Mikhail Milovich-Shvili is another example of this in Petersburg at the time. We're bumping up against the clock as I see. And there's one thing I wanted to throw out. It's the question I asked at the very outset. We've described this wild, wild criminal capital environment here for our listeners. This is the environment that Putin cut his teeth in as a politician, so to speak. It's one of the things that formed him. I think no less so than his KGB experience. What does this tell us about the man now, as we see him? We've seen him operate as president for a long time. Do we glean anything into understanding the Vladimir Putin of today from looking at this environment where he cut his political teeth?
Well, first of all, I would say that not all the top mafia figures are in prison. Clearly, we still have lots of groups operating. I mean, Mogilevich is still living in Moscow. Petrov, who was released under house arrest by the Spanish authorities in Spain, fled to St. Petersburg, and certainly has not been turned over by Putin nor arrested there. So I think that there still are people who are protected, and I think that's the key, that as long as you're regarded as reliable and that you contribute to the Obshchak, if you want to use a right mafia term, to the common good, which is now called the state, Putin's state, then Putin is still very cautious about making you an outsider. And I think that's continues to be a very important feature of his rule. I mean, just to switch back to Nemtsov, the week after Putin reappeared, he spoke both to the collegium of the MVD and to the collegium of the KGB with quite different messages. I mean, he talked about corruption in both cases, but he knows that these are two power bases that may potentially be at war with each other, and he needs this to stop because one view of how the Nemtsov thing went down is that the FSB was trying to use the Nemtsov murder as a kind of compromise against the MVD. So Putin is got to keep this big family together. And that's really when you say he cut his teeth in Petersburg, that's really the number one thing he learned in Petersburg was you either are going to go down with them if you allow them to fight each other without rules, or you're going to rise above them and use one against the other. And that's really what happened with Tambov. He used them He allowed them to win battles. They won against Perm Mafia, for example. So he's run the state in that way.
Mark, last word to you before we call it a day, call it a week.
Yeah, I very much agree with what Karen said about that he learned this lesson of how to operate in such an environment and the importance of creating coalitions that have rules. two other brief points is I mean, you'd mentioned the extent to which the liberals saw Putin as one of them. And again, I think it's worth noting that Putin really was and is a modernizer, which is probably why the liberals saw him as being on their side. It wasn't just simply that he was smart at playing them off against each other and everything else. I mean, I think it's because Putin represented change. And this is the third point, because it's not just that the experience of St. Petersburg in the 1990s sort of was where he cut his teeth. The experience of St. Petersburg in the 1990s is, as it were, his formative experience of post-Soviet Russia. You know, he had just basically sort of come from East Germany. He'd missed all the tumult of the perestroika years in the Soviet Union, and he came to this absolute messy, bloody sort of debacle that was the 1990s. And so, again, I think it has contributed to this sense that not just do I have to sort of, you know, create corrupt coalitions and everything else, but that sense that this is not just about his own personal survival, but about really the survival of Russia as a even halfway civilized and certainly sort of capable construct. I mean, I think this is what he feels he's struggling against. He sees it as a binary, my power vertical or that kind of a mess. Of course, we wouldn't necessarily see it in those terms, but I think it explains his perspective.
You give him more credit than most on that score. And on that note, I guess we'll have to wrap it up for today. That's all we have time for. But I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russian organized crime and security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Miami, Ohio, has been Karen Dawisha, director of the Heviger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at the University of Miami, Ohio, and author of the recently published and excellent book, Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? If you haven't read it, do so. I got my copy. Thank you both for an enlightening discussion.
A pleasure.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable and totally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow, at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.